for a variety of reasons. First of all, Ralph Soldatchik has officially published very little, relatively speaking, as compared to what his seminal minds have produced. In his name and so on, but there are only few authorized works that of which it can be said that he actually authored them. For a variety of reasons. First of all, Ralph Soldatchik has officially published very little, relatively speaking, as compared to what his seminal minds have produced. In his name and so on, but there are only few authorized works that of which it can be said that he actually authored them, and especially works of any length that were written systematically in an attempt to present a complete idea. But it's more than that. He is essentially, and I must say in introduction, I'm not a Talmudist, so I wasn't privileged to hear him in the many informal situations or classroom situations, and I'm sure that some of the things I say may be contradicted by Talmudim who studied with him and under him and have heard him discuss certain issues which I am not privy to, and I don't realize that he did or didn't discuss, but certainly he has not brought them to publication. We can only judge a thinker by what he publishes and what he produces officially. Another problem with him is that he's essentially a homiletician. He probably is the greatest homiletician, if there's such a word in our time. What I mean by this is the vehicle of his communication is homiletics. Even though the word Torosh has been used in a derogatory sense in the past, I think he has elevated it to the highest possible level as a great art of communicating ideas through the interpretation of classical texts. Homiletics has its own dynamics, and as a little bit of a practitioner myself, I know that the methodology of homiletics has its own dynamics in the sense that once you get started, you get carried away with the chat of interpretation, and it may carry you into different directions at different times. So sometimes you may give the impression that you're saying different things at different times. And that's the problem with homiletics. He has actually authored two major works, two long essays, which are the focus of any attempt to understand his teaching and his philosophy, and they were written 21 years apart. The first one was written in Hebrew in 1944, entitled Ish HaLacha, the man of Halacha, or Halachic man. It was later translated in the 80s by Lawrence Kaplan, a professor of Jewish thought and studies at McGill University, and 21 years later, in 1965, Tradition, the intellectual publication of the Rabbinical Council of America, published The Lonely Man of Faith, a lengthy essay on Jewish philosophy. The problem is that already a lot of comments are beginning to come up. There is a literature, a secondary literature appearing on the scene already. Several major articles appearing in Modern Judaism, which is published by Johns Hopkins University. In Tradition, in the Festschrift in honor of Rabbi Wurzberger, an article appeared by Dr. Fox, responding to these articles and so on and so forth. The problem is with these two essays, if you look at them at first glance, and even after second glance, they don't come up with the same results. And therefore, to try to create sort of a unified system becomes somewhat difficult, but it's understandable. a person can rethink after 21 years. There are many thinkers of whom books have been written, the early so-and-so and the later so-and-so. So it's not, a person doesn't have to be consistent throughout life and come up with the same answers all the time. One can at least see the roots of the second essay in the first. And some attempts have been made to reconcile the two. I don't know how far I'll get, but I'll try to do the best I can. To the man in the street, quote-unquote, Rav Soloveitchik is the answer to the dream of the modern Orthodox Jew. Yet, as I mentioned, one of the interpretive articles that appeared in modern Judaism by two professional philosophers, Orthodox philosophers, come up with a completely different conclusion. Their conclusion is that Rav Soloveitchik is really an old-fashioned yeshiva man in the garb of modern language and secular knowledge. That his real ultimate ideal, which according to them is the Ish Halacha, is the ultimate litvak, so to speak, the Talmud Chacham, and everything else is just that much decoration, let's put it this way. Now, why is he the answer to the dream of the modern Orthodox Jew in the street? The fact is that he does not, at least in his official writings, he may have talked to Talmidim about it in the shiur, in his official writings, he does not address the major theological and intellectual questions that plague modern man. Now he says it himself. In the opening page or paragraph, so to speak, of The Lonely Man of Faith, he says the following. I have never been seriously troubled by the problem of the biblical doctrine of creation vis-a-vis the scientific story of evolution at both the cosmic or the organic levels. Nor have I been perturbed by the confrontation of the mechanistic interpretation of the human mind with the biblical spiritual concept of man. And these are the two major confrontations of science and religion. One is the theory of evolution, and may I add also the geological age of the earth, and the whole scientific posture, the scientific method vis-a-vis the religious posture. This has just never bothered me. It bothers most modern people, most academically inclined, intellectually inclined modern people. He's also not been bothered by the mechanistic interpretation of the human mind with the biblical spiritual concept of man. In other words, the difference between psychology and neshama. Where do you place the concept of neshama within the scientific parameters of psychological analysis of the structure of the human personality? Now this is a major problem for modern theologian, and he completely ignores it. He says it doesn't bother. I don't believe that it never bothered him. It means it never bothered him enough that he has to, for a man who is very reluctant to express his opinion in print, hasn't felt necessary to respond to it in print and publicly. Moreover, yes, I have not been perplexed by the impossibility of fitting the mystery of revelation into the framework of historical empiricism. And that is the whole issue that we have with the heterodox, secular, and liberal religious world. The possibility to accept literal revelation, the way we believe in it, that the Torah was, as one, as Jacob Petuchowski put it, one of the outstanding scholars and theologians of the Reform movement, he says, we cannot accept that Moses was nothing else but the secretary who would either shorthand or typed up what was dictated to him verbally by God. I mean, the concept of of a literal and historical revelation versus a more vague concept of inspiration and revelation, which is accepted widely by the liberal religion, is one of the major issues of contemplative theology and is the parting point between orthodox and non-orthodox theology. Now, he does not address himself to that. Furthermore, I have not even been troubled by the theories of biblical criticism which contradict the very foundations upon which the sanctity and the integrity of scriptures rest. And by the time you're through with this paragraph, he admits that he hasn't addressed any of the major theological issues of our time. And yet, the man in the street thinks that he is the answer to all the problems of the modern Orthodox Jew. Now, the reason is not what he said and what he taught, but the reason is what he is. And I think that is the reason why he is the answer to the dream of the modern Orthodox Jew. May I add also that he said very little about the Holocaust and very little about the state of Israel as well. Most of it is homiletical and rhapsodic about the state of Israel, but not really theological analytical. His official writings have been described as phenomenology of the religious experience. He essentially attempts to describe what a religious experience is, rather what religion has to say in confrontation with a non-religious world. Now again, coming back to the question, why is he so revered? Because of what he is. I don't think that he has an equal. In his time, maybe in this century, and I may be as daring as to say, going back to the times of the Rambam, or the great figures of the Golden Age of Stein, of one who is such a impressive and phenomenal three-dimensional scholar and intellectual. When I say three-dimensional, I mean not only one who knows a lot, but knows so much with a depth dimension. In all fields of human knowledge, I don't think that he has an equal, and maybe going back to the golden era of Spain. But knowledge is not his only strength. He is one of the greatest communicators of his age. He is an extraordinary, unfortunately he is no longer because of illness, may have a refusal learning, but he is an extraordinary oral communicator, even much better than President Reagan. And he is a phenomenal writer as well whenever he commits himself to write. I remember hearing him the first time, I went to Yotzat Rosh, when he was betokfo, when he was at his peak, and I sat there mesmerized for 6 hours straight, 3 hours halacha and 3 hours agoda. And about 2,000 people sat there mesmerized for 6 hours. Now, I don't have to tell you what it means to sit for 6 hours. I don't have to give you all the physiological additional problems that nobody was conscious of for 6 straight hours. I don't have to tell you where the biggest line was after the lecture. And they didn't have any commercials in the middle. I once read in the paper that they measured the popularity of television programs by the water supply, the effect on the water supply during commercials. You see? Because then they figure how many people, how much water is being used, that means so many people are watching the program. there was no impact on the water supply during his 6-hour lecture. I remember also, I was learning a Torah V'Da'as at the time, I'm a Muslim of Torah V'Da'as, and one of the very few fans of him in Torah V'Da'as, and one of the Rosh Yeshiva, young Rosh Yeshiva in Torah V'Da'as, who was a great tzaddik and a great Talmud Chacham, and one of the most honest people in the world, unfortunately no longer amongst the living, and he went to listen to a Yotzeit Rosh Hashanah. And he came back and he said to his colleagues, Sigrein Gainer Gainers, ultimate Gainers. And he was told in no uncertain terms, it may be so, but don't you ever do it again. He said, it's reminiscent, it reminds me of the story of the murder of Yehuda, that was the beginning of the battle between the Snipe and the Hasidim. A Jew came in Yeshua, and he said, V'yatzmach b'kone v'kore Mashiach by the Kaddish. He said, oh, main, but never say it again. The comment of another Rosh Yeshiva in Torah V'Da'as, also big Talmud Chacham, big Lamban, they told him over his longest Yeshiva. So he said, how long did this be? He said, 3 hours. So I told him, 3 hours. He said, I could have said this in 20 minutes and half an hour. And he's right too. He's right too. See? Now if you listen to a man like Wiesel, for instance, what he says in an hour, for which he gets $10,000, somebody else can tell you 2 minutes. You condense it, this is what it's all. It's not good. But he didn't suffer, and we have to have hope, and we have to have this, and so I could say it in 2 sentences. And he gets $10,000 to speak in an hour. There's a difference. He's a literary. He communicates, he draws a picture. People pay for art and entertainment and for ennoblement. They don't just pay for ideas. Right? And the person who has that ability is an enormous communicator, an impressive communicator, because what people are left with is not only the idea, but they are ennobled and enriched by it. And sometimes they are that even if they don't know the idea. In fact, one of his Talmidim told me, one of his close Talmidim, that once during vacation time, they took a little trip together and they passed by in a fair or something, a booth, with a handwriting expert. So they thought, you know, let's see, what is the handwriting expert going to say? He walked over to the booth and he wrote something. The handwriting expert looked at this and said, this man must be a great poet. That's very telling. Didn't say he's a great philosopher, he's a great scientist, he's a great magician, he's a great poet. Because that enormous koach of painting with words that this man possessed is really uncanny. And, of course, adds enormously to his popularity. Now, I will not be a chochem tonight, not that I'm a chochem at any other night. And I will not go al rishon rishon al achon achon. And I will start with a little synopsis, so to speak, of his second essay, The Lonely Man of Faith, for several reasons. Number one, we have a klal in the Gemara, Hilchos HaKebasro. If there's a machlokes achronim, a machlokes in Amoron, between early Amoron and later Amoron, we pass them like the later Amoron. The assumption being that they are operating with the benefit of the information that the earlier Amoron had, and they analyzed and studied it. So this is an educated second opinion which we follow. Therefore, my instinct also is that it's more him than the first one. The first one was more biographical of his ancestors. I think the second essay is more autobiographical about himself, which he readily admits in the article that it's autobiographical. The second reason, the later article is more generally religious, of the general religious experience, and therefore is applicable to homos religiosos, as he calls it, the religious man in general, not only specifically to the Jew, even though his conclusions obviously are Jewish conclusions. The third reason is very simply, it's much more complex and much more analytical, and I think it's something good to start with. What he does in that essay, The Lonely Man of Faith, he takes a brilliant piece of homiletics and turns it into a typological phenomenology of religion. Now, this sounds very obscure, but let me explain very simply. What he does is he paints ideal types. Now, ideal types, just like a mathematician, let's say, will give you a formula of a mathematical formula, or even in high school you have geometry, you have a triangle and definition of a triangle, that the, all the angles, what they add up to, and so on and so forth. While, as I mentioned last week, in nature we never find a perfect triangle, but conceptually we have a perfect triangle. Similarly, one can construct a perfect model of a perfect religious individual, or an individual has a perfect religious experience. That doesn't mean to say that anyone ever has that experience, or anyone comes close to it, or that it isn't mixed with other things. But in order to understand what the experience is, you create the perfect model for the sake of understanding what it's all about. That is typological, and the word phenomenology means the phenomenon of the experience, rather than trying to interpret theologically what the metaphysics is, what the reason is this. The person to understand, just like you explain gravity, you explain everything else, how do you explain religiosity? Okay? So that becomes phenomenology, and typological means that the method used is to describe a type rather than to explain an individual. And he does that by a brilliant piece of exegesis on Sefer Bereshit. It doesn't take much homiletical wonderment to realize that there are two stories of the creation of Adam Rishon. One right in the beginning, where you have a very terse and simple statement, Zocho Nekevo Bora Osam, God created man, male and female, he created them. He created them B'Tselem Elokim. He told them all the wonderful things, to rule over the birds in the sky and the fish in the ocean and the beasts on the ground. Yechishuha, and you will conquer the world. And it's left at that, and gets the divine blessing. Then, after Sheni, after Yom HaShishi, after we made Kiddush already, we have another story of Adam. That he made him out of earth, and he blew into him a Nishmas Chayim. There Adam is alone, alright? And he looks around and he searches highest loifers. He gives them all names. And according to Chachomim, he tries to relate to them even physically. And he finds no satisfaction. And God saw that it is not good for a man to be alone. He discovers existential loneliness, alright? He is alone and he feels alone. And finally God appears and out of his own physical being creates his mate, and he says, now and so on. We got it. Now biblical criticism has pounced on this, obviously. You're dealing with two sources, the redactor, with a capital R, of the Bible, had several sources in the story of creation of man, and he sort of dovetailed them one after the other, and that is the work of the redactor. The parshonim on the Torah have a simplistic approach, that the first parsha speaks about a generality, about the creation, like a headline, like the opening caption of an essay, but the details are reserved for the later story. He comes with up with a brilliant idea that the Torah is not telling us two stories of creation, but the story of the creation of two men in one. That we are a dualistic creature. That there are, what he puts, Adam the first and Adam the second, there are two Adams in each one of us. Right? And that we were created as two Adams. And what the Torah is trying to do in its biblical language is didactic and not historical or biological. The Torah is telling us what to see in ourselves. I created you as Adam the first, and I created you as Adam the second. And the two conflict, not because they are conflicting sources, but they are conflicting components in the human personality, in human existence. That was the little game that he devised to bring out his point of the typology of the religious personality. Now, who are these two Adams? And let me just say immediately, this has nothing to do with the Yetzer Tov, the Yetzer Ra. This is another problem which he doesn't discuss, because he doesn't discuss psychology and all this. This is, Yetzer Tov, Yetzer Ra is operative in all parts of the human existence. He doesn't touch on that. That dualism that we always talk about, that your normal sermon talks about, there's goodness and badness and so on, we have to see that the good conquers the bad, this is not touched here, that's not the problem. He is talking about two different existencia. It has nothing to do with the parts, it's with the whole. We are two different wholes, not stickler. It's not half and half. We are half Adam 1 and half Adam 2. We are a whole Adam 1 and a whole Adam 2. They're not components of a personality. These are dual dimensions of one existence. Yeah. Now, who is Adam the First? Adam the First, he calls majestic man. The Chesuha person. That which drives humanity to conquer its environment, to order its environment by an imposed system of law and order, which the scientist and the technologist and the philosopher place on that world. The world is chaotic without the imprint of the unification that man achieves intellectually through his understanding of that world. And he is determined not to be overwhelmed by this world and its chaos. He gives it law and order and meaning of how it works and how it operates. He learns to rule that world by these laws which he discovers in order to make his life more comfortable, more convenient, to increase not only the chance of his survival, his physical survival, but of his mental and spiritual survival as well. He is not terribly concerned of why the world is here. The why doesn't bother him, because the why makes you melancholy and makes you worried and makes you confused. Why is there a world altogether? He doesn't bother about that. He's concerned that there is a world and I am going to conquer it. He is bold, he is aggressive, he is a conqueror. He takes this world and rules it, and by ruling it, he makes it work for him. He is essentially self-confident. He is the man who ultimately goes out into space and lands on the moon. Now, he is not a person without ethics and without morals. You may be under the impression that we are dealing with an amoral person. We are dealing with a technologist, with a person who is only interested to make a more convenient life, to make a better mousetrap, to bring some better washing machines, better cars, better trains, better planes. No. He wants, he is also what he calls an aesthete, an aesthetic person. He wants life to be beautiful and pleasant. Under the word aesthete, we can subsume pleasure, beauty, art, all these things. He likes things nice. I think the prototypical concept of the aesthete and the this type of man would be Greek civilization, which combined whatever science was at the time, science and art, where there was a whole system where everything was put together with efficiency and beauty. To give an example, for those who have read a little bit of the Greek classics, a very famous and popular classic, Plato's Republic, which is read in my day anyway, it was read in every course one, economics one, political science one, philosophy one, and it was required reading, because Takemas is a very seminal book, and there's something to say about all these things. So Plato starts out with the question, what is justice? And what does he wind up with? He winds up with a beautifully structured society. So maybe you have justice. Justice means that everybody does what he does best, and there's perfect harmony in the nature. Harmony is an aesthetic concept. It's a beauty concept. Harmony in colors and painting, harmony in music, and what have you, in sculpture and everything else. Harmony, beauty. Ethics to the Greeks. Hirsch already wrote about this. To the Greeks, ethics was beautiful. They didn't have that passionate Sturm und Drang, the drive for the ethical in life. Ethics, it's nice, it's beautiful. He builds beautiful structures, all right? Religion also enhances life. Religion has an aesthetic dimension to it. In fact, William James, in his The Variety of Religious Experience, argues that this is the power of the Catholic Church, is because they are able to introduce so much aesthetics in their churches, with the vestments, and with the pictures, and with the mice, and with the chefs, and this is very helpful, and it's more impressive on people than the dry theology and service of Protestantism. So, it's certain religion has a definitely an aesthetic dimension. It makes life more orderly. Isn't it nice to start out the session of Congress with a prayer by a garoch or by a rabbi? And it adds a certain dignity. In other words, the life man wants dignity in life, alright? He is one little being, he sees a big cosmos, he's puzzled by it, he puts his mind to work, he begins to organize it, organization and knowledge is control, because then you know what to do with it, you know what it is, you know how to handle it, and then you want to dignify it. Why do they have all these religious ceremonies in America? I mean, what difference does a prayer make to the United States Congress? And let's be realistic. Or what does it make for an invocation to some kind of a dinner in their circles? But it adds a certain dignity. Religion, it's sort of an underpinning of all what we are doing, that there is some higher power that benignly looks upon us and says, you are all right. Okay? And it is rooted, in a sense, in Kantian thinking and Hermann Korn, who was the subject of Rabbi Soloveitchik's PhD thesis, the Kantian approach to that, after he had totally destroyed all medieval rationalistic thrusts of trying to explain God or to prove God, he resurrects God, so to speak, as a basis for our, what he calls, practical reason, for our ethical, axiological system, all right? It makes a lot of sense. Everybody feels better and feels really more fulfilled if he knows what he is doing is part of a more universal system which is sanctioned by the God. But it's not really something that grabs you by purpose, so to speak, and it's not a relational thing, it's a structural thing again. The God in the religion of the aesthete is also structural, aesthetic,
rather than passionate and relational. The ideal Adam the First, the most successful Adam the First before the last of aging, is the mathematical physicist who creates the theoretical structures with which you can approach any phenomenon in the physical world and try to explain it in such terms. Now, Adam the First has community as well. What is community to him? Community is not l'autovriosa odom levado. Man feels existentially lonely, this is why he has to have other people. No. He has to have other people because he can't do it by himself. In other words, there the female is Eze Kenegdo, in a sense. Well, that comes in later, actually. The Eze Kenegdo he interprets differently. I mean, we tend to interpret Eze Kenegdo as well. But he says that originally men and women are created together because they couldn't live without each other. Because one human being, a Robinson Crusoe, is fiction, cannot really exist. And you have to live in community, because no one person, by virtue of the limitations of our physical capacity, we cannot do everything ourselves. So we need community. Alright? Today the mass production of man is made possible not only by machinery, by division of labor. One does one thing, does the other thing. If I have to do everything myself, it's impossible. Therefore, there's a certain utility in community. And Adam the First has community, but his community really is only a utilitarian one. It's a pragmatic one. It's a community which makes possible his functioning as Adam the First. But it is not really a relational one. It's not where they share their innermost feelings, and where the comparison would be like a basketball team. A team. Now one person cannot win the ball game. You have to have five people. And if the five people, each one runs on their own, you're not going to win the ball game either. You have to have five people who work together. It doesn't mean to say that they necessarily have a profound relationship with each other. They may even hate each other's work, you know. But they want to make a lot of money, they know they have to win, and they have to win. The only way they win is to play together. They may even develop a certain friendly relationship. Well, like you may develop with people in your working place. But it doesn't mean to say that there is a really what modern existentialists have named the I-thou relationship, a relationship that one really relates to the other on a very personal, intimate level. It's a very functional, it's a very prudent, it's a very pragmatic relationship, it's very effective in achieving the goals of Adam the First. That's why he had his wife right away, and according to his interpretation, man and wife are not only husband and wife in the romantic sense, they are also a miniature practical community. By working together and facing the practical problems of life together, it is a team partnership, besides being what in Adam the Second would become an interpersonal or intimate relationship. Why was he called Tselem Elokim? Because Tselem Elokim means creativity. He is creative. This Adam the First is very creative. He has confidence in his creativity, he has an urge to create, and he goes ahead and creates. He creates beautiful superstructures that make life passable, adequate, and aesthetic. Alright? And he keeps on creating in this world. And the Tselem Elokim, according to his interpretation, which has been, by the way, interpreted differently by many different people, but his interpretation of Tselem Elokim, according to this exegesis, is the capacity to create, to make form out of chaos, like Hashem took the Tohu Bavohu and made a world out of it, so Adam the first takes his tohu bohu, his chaos that he finds in the universe that surrounds him, and he puts more and order into it, and he creates it into a workable world that serves him. Adam the first has no need for redemption. He is not troubled. He doesn't worry about his own existence. He does not necessarily face up his own mortality. He does not worry about what is this all about, what do I mean, what does the world mean, what is this all about, what is the past, what is the future. There was a big past without me, there's going to be a big future without me, where do I fit in? These things don't trouble him. Therefore, he does not need any redemptive experience. He doesn't need tshuva, he doesn't need redemption, he doesn't really need passionate prayer or prostration, he doesn't feel mo'oni mechaya, ofani bechaya, I'm dust, and like we say Yom Kippur, he doesn't experience that. Because he's not dust, he goes to the moon. He's not dust. He uses the dust. He makes gold out of the dust. In short, you could almost say that Adam the first is the American dream. The beautiful home in the suburbs, with at least two cars, and a dog, and 2.5 children, and all the other things that you maybe know better than I do. Alright, that's the American dream. Liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Happiness is the aesthete, the law. Everything should be nice, orderly, and I should sit back at night, roll up my, put on my house dozen jacket, smoke the pipe, surrounded by my family, else is good, else is fine, I'm happy. And that is Adam the first. Adam the second is very unsure of himself. He's not bold, he's humble. When he looks out in the cosmos and sees the chaos, he doesn't try to, he's not worried how it works. He's immediately struck by, what is this? How did this come into being? What does it mean for a world to exist altogether? And who am I? I'm the only creature. The animals don't worry about this. In my consciousness, all of a sudden, I'm aware of this world, I'm aware of myself, I'm aware of the vulnerability with which I live, I'm aware that 1900 and so and so, I wasn't here yet, and at some future date, who knows, 19X, I will not be around anymore. What does it all mean? He sees himself not merely as a member of the species Homo sapiens, but he sees himself as an individual. Of course, here he has already the advantage, Salvation has the advantage of the impact made by existentialist philosophy, particularly Soren Kierkegaard, whom he quotes lavishly throughout his writings, who was really the first theologian who, in his attacks on Hegel's grandiose plans of evolving ideas and our little specks in the big plan, said, who addresses poor me, the individual? What difference does all that make to me when I have to face my own trouble, my own sorrows, my own contingencies? Every human being is unique, has no one other. Ergo, by definition, Adam the second is lonely, because there is no one that he can really relate to totally, because he's totally different than anyone else. He is lonely, he is wondering, he is unsure. His uniqueness creates a very serious emotional problem for him. He is anxious, he is unfulfilled, he is haunted by a need for the search of meaning. What does the whole world mean? He is awed by the enigmatic universe, and he is inclined, just opposite to Adam the first, who is inclined to be bold and conquering, he is inclined to surrender. he feels himself overwhelmed by all the contingencies and the unknowns and anxieties that he faces in this world. And he feels the overwhelming need for redemption. And redemption means not just the Tziyas Mitzrayim. Redemption means Hotziyo Mimazgan Anavzi, Nafshi, Dovid HaMelech said. Bring out my soul from its imprisonment. My soul is troubled. And being redeemed means to find a spiritual haven where Adam the Second can stand with the same kind of security and certainty and assurance and with meaning as Adam the First does in his ultimate accomplishment. And he can't get it just by speculating, because he's left in doubt, he's left with uncertainty, nobody has all the answers. He can only find it in a redemptive gesture, which means in something which all of a sudden catapults him onto a new plane of existence where he finds a certain serenity, because having made contact with what we shall see in a moment is God Himself. He is essentially unstructured, because like a child in Toys R Us, somehow, by contributing something, by doing something with himself, which we might interpret it as a sacrifice, he redeems himself and meets with God, and with that eternally. Somehow, by contributing something, by doing something with himself, which we might interpret it as a sacrifice, he redeems himself and meets with God, and with that eternal reality, which is the only one that can put him to peace, with that mysterium tremendum, as the Protestant theologians call it. But God made it so, and he willed it so, that both Adams should dwell in us simultaneously. And it is very difficult to be one Adam totally and exclusively. Because whatever we do on one side, the other side mourns us, you know. It lays in its claim. And it's very difficult for us to attempt to dwell totally in one world to the exclusion of the other. Now this Adam the Second, while he is in the matzav of Adam the Second, has a double problem. On the one hand, he has that urge, he's also Adam the First, he wants the world over him, he would like to see the world that way, but he can't quite do it. But he also wants to find menucha sanefesh, so to speak, in his matzav of Adam the Second. And this is where God steps in. God reveals himself as man seeks community. And now he comes to his philosophy of community, which is very unique as compared to other existentialists that we'll see in a moment. He calls it the covenantal community as compared to the functional community of the majestic man. The covenantal community is a community that shares that experience of Adam the Second, who searched together for something, who try to comfort each other as they are looking for answers, as they are looking for interpretation of meaning of existence, as they reveal to each other their loneliness and share with each other their anxieties. And this is where God steps in. God reveals himself through the covenantal community and impresses on that community his ideas and his norms, which ultimately redeem the individual as a member of that community. The community of Adam the Second is a tzibbur, is a minyan, is 10 people who pray together, not 5 people who play basketball together. Because this is not a question of seeking efficiency in something. It is a joining up of lonely hearts, so to speak, who together cry out to God in a voice of unison, because what they share is not sameness, because each one is unique, but what they share is the same concerns, not the same interests of achievement, but the same existential concerns that gnaw at their hearts and souls. And they commune with each other, communicate with each other in the search of that higher existence in which they attempt to find peace, which they find in the norms which God imposes on this covenantal community. In that community, the individual also overcomes the angst, the existential fear of non-being, the confrontation with death, because the past and the present and the future are a continuum. He sees himself as part of the whole faith community all the way back to Sinai or even to Avraham Avinu. And he knows that his task is to go beyond what was left to him by the past, and that his task is to leave something from which the future can go beyond him. And that makes the present meaningful and significant and redeeming. And this is made possible by his sense of community, that he is a member of Klal Yisrael, so to speak, which started before him and will continue after him. There's a beautiful, I don't want to be marav, but there's a beautiful Gemara Maseches Tanis about Chone HaMagel. Famous story of Chone HaMagel, before he went to sleep, he saw a person plant a box of tree, you know. A carrot tree, you know, Boxer used to call it, Johnsburg, whatever you want to call it. It's very soon in Yonah Dayom. And he saw him plant this, and he said, "You're an old man, this takes about 70 years until it develops, you'll never eat the fruit of it." And he said, "But if I were, my grandfather planted the tree, and I eat its fruit, I'm planting a tree for my grandson." And then he fell asleep and he slept for 70 years. He slept for 70 years and he knew the Posek HaYinuk HaCholman and so on. But essentially, this is the law. The Jew always felt, my grandfather left me a Yerusha, his heritage, his spiritual heritage. I have to make sure that my grandchildren have my heritage. Like that famous Balchuba song about who is going to be the grandfather to my children. Right? I had a Zaydi, who's going to be the Zaydi to my grandchildren, to my children. And this is the membership in the covenantal community, which makes all of life contiguous, past, present, and future, and this is how he is redeemed. Mind you, again, there is very little theology here. He doesn't go into Olam Habo, he omits the whole eschatology. Mashiach and the Tzvias HaMesim and Olam Habo, all the Yud Gimel Rishonim that bothered all the theologians. He speaks strictly in the here and now religious experience. It's not what you're going to get in Olam Habo. The Jew finds redemptiveness not only because he knows that he will be rewarded Olam Habo later on, that he is immortal. He finds that redemptive gesture in the fact that he is a member of the eternal community of Klal Yisrael, the covenantal community. It is a psychological and emotional moment, again, an experiential moment, and not a theological one. Then he goes on to show that the Master, he, Adam II, takes these norms and places them on Adam I. Because if you take Kamat all the mitzvahs in the Torah, with exception maybe of Tfilah and Tshuva, some of the mitzvah Shebelev, but if you take most of the Master's mitzvahs that we have in the Torah, take place in the Adam the first world. You have to take the physical Esekin Lulav, you put on tefillin made out of leather, and the passages are written on parchment with ink. They're all physical matter. So all the mitzvahs are performed in the world of Adam the first. And his strong implication is, he doesn't say it's a mamish beferish, but the strong implication is that through the norm of the Torah and mitzvahs, we also reunite Adam the first and Adam the second. In other words, Adam the second not only comes to terms with himself as Adam the second through the norms in the normative covenantal community, which he, together with them, he discovered God for himself personally, but also since these norms are actually played out in the objective world of Adam the first, he sort of puts his imprimatur of his norm on this Adam the first world, and somehow the conflict and the dichotomy between the two worlds also can be resolved. Now he doesn't say that the Pharisee, because he sort of vacillates, and he says, he almost at times implies that we are almost condemned to a certain amount of tension because we float back and forth. But on the other hand, the implication at other points, I'm not quite sure what he means. I must admit, I didn't hear this in person. It's really hard to tell from the essay itself. But you could go either way. You could imply, again, out of his, I'm sure, his own autobiographical experience, that there's a tension between the two worlds. Or maybe in the sense of the ideal typology, that he envisages the possibility that Adam the second can really find his way in Adam the first world with the norms that the Torah has given. If that is the case, he owes a great deal to one philosopher that he never mentions. And maybe that's why he doesn't mention him. I'm not trying to be facetious. Because he is so much, the structure is so much like Martin Buber, but because he disagrees fundamentally with many things of Martin Buber, maybe that's why he doesn't mention him. He's very easy in quoting Kierkegaard and so on, but Buber he never mentioned. And yet, there is a tremendous imprint of Buber's thinking.
Now, some of Buber's thinking has become very popular and is used on a very popular level, just like Freud's psychology. Everybody uses our Freud and Slip Freud and those. I mean, there are certain terms that are supposed to be Freud and everybody knows, even if they never read the book about Freud. But there are certain things about Buber that everybody knows, even though they never read Buber. And that is the I-thou and the I-it. Now, if you take the two worlds, Adam the first and Adam the second, there is great similarity, even though there are great differences, of Martin Buber's I-it and I-thou world. The I-it world, according to Buber, now Buber's approach is essentially epistemological. That means is, how does man know? How does man know? He starts out with a fundamental question which salvation does not start out with. How do we know what we know? What is the accuracy and the instrumentality of human knowledge? He does not seem to deal with this. Right? But Buber starts out with this. And Buber says that we have two ways of seeing the same thing. There are not two people. There are just two ways in which our mind operates, in which our being operates. One is an I-it and one is an I-thou. I-it is very much like Adam the first. The whole world is my object. I control the world, okay? And I look at everything, what I can do with it, I categorize it, the scientist, that is the I-it approach, who has everything in order, everything lined up, and systematized. It's impersonal, it's not relational. The I-thou is when the whole I meets the whole thou. When being, one being meets another being totally and completely, and then one sees and hears different things. It sounds very mysterious, but it's very poignant in a way. Take the difference, how a flower is viewed by the botanist, or a flower is viewed by the poet. All right? Now, the botanist sees petals and first of the heisen the other meister's dog, I should forget, you know. And he puts it and he squeezes it and he puts it in a category and he puts it in the laboratory. The poet sees the beauty and the red and the green and he says to me, he talks to me, he's not a sugar. It's also Emma's. He meets the flower, I thou. He has a relationship with that flower. Right? The botanist has no relationship with the flower. He takes it, he slices it up, he categorizes it, and he puts it in two files. That's the idea. His whole philosophy is built on that. The whole religious view only emerges in the I-thou relationship, because in the I-it everything is determined, there are no miracles, there is no God, there's no revelation, there's nothing. All these things happen only in an I-thou relationship, and I permit myself with my whole being to meet. Buber said, all being is meeting, the in-between, the dialogue. The philosophy of dialogue, alright? Of course, that is different from Salvation, because this is not two different ways of looking at things. What Salvation says is that we have two different people operating within us, two different sets of needs, alright? But the dualism, that kind of dualism of an objective individual takes everything as his object, and the person who encounters everything existentially, this dichotomy is in structure very similar. And Buber also said that the norms of man are achieved in the I-thou relationship, and then he uses these values in the I-it world. And he also says that to fluctuate between the two worlds, you can't live in only one and not in the other. So structurally there is a great similarity, but as I said, there are great differences, and I don't want to elaborate them because I may get a little bit philosophically too technical. I have enough of a hard time not trying to lose you. Like a central telephone, exchange, which is the eternal thou. All right. But that's besides the point. In Salvece, the other, Adam the second does not meet the thou in a flower on a tree, not even another fellow human being. He is more Kierkegaardian that way, because man is unique and does not meet the other that way.
Community creates really the idea, because it's only community that can really begin to communicate with others. Through the commonly experienced religion is looked upon as some kind of an oddball. It's particularly in American society, until relatively recently, it was a shame anybody should be interested in philosophy. Poetry was considered to be effeminate, you know, the man was not, he had to hide the poetry book under it, wanted to read poetry and read literature, you know what I mean? He had to be down to earth and doors and conquer the world and make it and at best be a scientist, I mean, at worst, I should say, but not get involved in ultimate questions and Shakyamuni and Habermas. I mean, there are very few philosophy students on American campuses. There are even very few history students. There are few any students that's not computers and law and medicine or whatever. So he says that the Adam the Sixth, particularly in American society, until relatively recently, it was a shame anybody should be interested in philosophy. Poetry was considered to be effeminate, you know, the man was not, he had to hide the poetry book under it, wanted to read poetry and read literature, you know what I mean? He had to be down to earth and doors and conquer the world and make it and make it all money and at best be a scientist, I mean, at worst, I should say, but not get involved in ultimate questions and Shakyamuni and Habermas. I mean, there are very few philosophy students on American campuses. There are even very few history students. There are few any students that's not computers and law and medicine or whatever. So he says that the Adam the Second type of person feels doubly lonely because there is no recognition and appreciation of the concerns of Adam the Second in our contemporary society. All right. Achan, the second essay. The first essay is much simpler and already shows indication of Adam the Second, of the lonely man of faith, but has a completely different approach and a different way of explaining a religious experience, not necessarily the religious experience. And the a religious experience which he's trying to explain is the one that he saw in the house of his forefathers. The ultimate misnagdishir personality. As one contemporary theologian put it, the ish halacha is a misnagdish phenomenology of awesome proportions. Here he also starts out the two types, which are comparable in a sense. You can see in Dumbre the two types in the lonely man of faith. There he calls what he later would call Adam the First, he calls cognitive man, coming from cognition, from Sefer, the Baal Sefer, who approaches the world with law and order, who orders the world, very similar to Adam the First in a sense. He doesn't deal so much with the concerns of Adam the First as he does in Adam the First, but rather with the intellectual approach to the world that is more important than the ish halacha. Now, this, a cognitive man, is the man of science and philosophy. What he later calls Adam the Second, he calls here the homo religiosus, the religious personality. The religious personality has a tendency, again, to worry, to fear, meaningless, and the essential differences that he underlines here is that cognitive man is very much in this world, is concerned with this world, and that this homo religiosus is otherworldly and is most typified by Eastern mysticism and by all classical strains in the Christian religion, where it is all emotion and feeling and romanticism and relating. And I suppose it would be pushed against the wall on that, he would include Hasidus, authentic original Hasidus into that category, where a lot of weight is placed on dancing of feeling and so on and so on and so forth. Now, there, he denigrates, to some extent, this homo religiosus. He writes with no sympathy for him. All right? And I would say that the reason he writes without sympathy for him, because then he was still, 21 years younger, very much under the influence of his home and his tradition, and his father and his grandfather's great-grandfather, and the entire glorious era of the Vilna Gaon through Balozhin and Briss, right, that looked down on uncertainty, unsureness, and settings up in how I feel and how I think and how I do, and you say Apshat and Arambam, and you solve the problem, and you feel good. So he disparages the homo religiosus. He paints him, like I often say, like the like the hermit enveloped in a lala on the Himalayas, you know, drinking goat's milk. You know what I mean? This is the homo religiosus, right? And the Jewish religion looks askance at this. It's a lot of emotions, and it's not tough. And he says the danger of this emotionalism is that it is possible for the human personality to become very emotional about something and to be extremely expressive, and then when push comes to shove, do just the opposite. This is that in history there were many Christian knights who would bow down before the cross in the church and cry with bitter tears and make confession, and they were religious, I ain't got so Marathons on. And then they went out and had innocent people killed. This ability to divorce real life from the religious experience is a danger inherent in homo religiosus, because it's very easy to get emotional. Like somebody once said, Miyala ba Hashem umiyokum ba kocha. So David HaMelech said, Miyala ba Hashem, who can get up to the Lord's mountain? Or but Miyokum in kocha, who can stay there? It's very easy to get ecstatic, you know. Yitzhak with the Balfuller, Yitzhak with the Dorsha, oh, my best high, not Takov. It's like they once they had a parlor meeting for UJA. So a guy got up and he delivered it for a heretical speech, and then he wanted to start calling the names. So one guy gets up, he says, ladies and gentlemen, I make a motion that we call out the names tomorrow. Right now we're too much under the influence of the speaker. You know what I mean? But they know that we're right now, who knows what they're gonna give. Let's cool off a little bit first, you know what I mean? Then we're giving what our nature is to give. Because what we're going to give now is not indicative of what we really are. And that's what he said, that is the danger of the homo religiosus. He becomes very excited, very emotional about everything else, but tachlis, okay? And here we see immediately where he places the Ish HaLacha. The Ish HaLacha to him is a man of iron-willed intellectual cognition of what the Torah wants. And he attacks or treats all of life and the cosmos around him with the same precision and with the same discipline as a scientist deals scientifically with the world around him. Like in his inimitable language, how he describes when he says when he sees a mayon, a wellspring of water, to him right away it is a structure in Yichus Mikvahs. Whether you need Zochran, those who are familiar with this, whether it's a kosher Zochran, and Mishpat HaSboros, and what the Shiurim, and you don't need the Mensor, I would characterize it by a pasuk in the Torah, which is really a real Jewish audacity, in a sense, religious audacity. When the Torah describes the creation of the moon and the sun, what does the Torah say? Yahavdu ben ayom ben alaylo. This is not a Chabad saw to differentiate between day and night. No, the whole of the oceans, the ma'aden. So Rashi says this is the ma'aden, so that the Jews later can make them turn because they go by the moon, by the month. That's the mason. The moon was created so that we can accomplish our chodesh, and we can make a yontif. That is the approach of this halakha. He looks at all of reality as chaos, which has to be straightened out, but instead of straightening out, discovering the law of how to make it work functionally, scientifically, he makes it work for him religiously. All right? The water becomes a mikveh, the sun, the moon becomes clears as Chodesh and Yom Tovim, a fruit becomes the subject of the Sabrochama Machtavim, all right? Everything becomes impressed with the halakha system, and he compares the ish halakha to the mathematical physicist who creates all the perceptions and all the ideas that are necessary to order that chaos which is the universe for himself. He tells the story of, I don't know whether it's the grandfather of Chaim or his mother's side, his grandfather, but from the same cheder. He had a Chabad chosid was about to kill in his shul. So when he got up to blow shofar, he started crying. Why are you crying? It's Rosh Hashanah, let's get that chip on out, you know. He started crying. He said, no, I don't understand you. Why don't you cry when you pick up the Esav in the Luda? A shofar is a mitzvah in the Torah. That's all that we have to do. As you tell the story, you know, when you look at Tia Shofar, there's a little filler there right after Yerotzen, and a she in bays. So this story is rather told, I think, from the, probably from Tola Hotchitzer. He was a big joker. So one chesed, chesed is like chavonis and this and that. And then he didn't know. One thing he says, what does she in bays mean? So he says, no, what she in bays mean? Shofar blows! So this is sort of what he told this chassid. So it's the laws. The Torah says, like the Rambam says, after all is said, and this and that, but the Torah says, oh, he gives little reasons here, and little shrek, and here, and I said, but the reason we blow is because the Torah says, I'm the Rosh Hashanah. All you have to do is to do your thing. You take the norm of the Torah, and again, he doesn't go into revelation how we got the norm, he doesn't talk about community here, vomit. He starts out with the total, full, if you want to call it blind, acceptance of the discipline, and if you follow the discipline, you will experience the results, you will know the end. And the results are that through this discipline of Torah, you control that chaotic world around you, and you will see a new experienced world. Now, he explains also with this why Rosen and Brisk were against the Musa movement. Because Musa is a little bit homeo religiosus. What am I? Who am I? Do I really mean it? Do I mean it? Don't I mean it? You start analyzing. Do I really mean it this small? Do I know this small? Do I do it because other people are watching or listening? He keeps self-analysis after analysis. He says, leave them alone. Show it to gloss. You do the mitzvahs. Everything else is going to happen. In other words, they saw in Musa an attempt to introduce the homo religiosus into the lifestyle of the ish halacha. So it's not only a question of waste of time. They felt it's not only a waste of time, but it undermines the boldness of the ish halacha. Now the ish halacha, just like the scientist, is created. You see the similarity to Adam HaRishon? The Adam the first, I mean? He is created. The importance to the ish halacha of Chiddusha Torah. What is Chiddusha Torah? He comes up with a Chiddush, a new concept, a new perception. How to conceive the halakhic system, how it affects reality. So just as the scientific science, man of science, the cognitive man, is created in discovering a new hypothesis in science, a new discovery, which now will enable him to control the system better, so the ish halacha through Chiddusha Torah comes up with new ideas and new concepts with which he will control the world around him. Now, as Lawrence Kaplan, who translated Ish Halacha, and was a keen student of God's philosophy, if you look at that very keenly, and even superficially, you see an enormous difference here. Because here, the Ish Halacha is really what Adam? He's really Adam the first.
He is the cognitive man, he has all the characteristics of the cognitive man. The only thing is his cognition is not scientific, but it is halakhic. But essentially he operates with the same korpus hanefesh and with the same attitudes as operates the cognitive man, which is Adam the first. So all of a sudden the dogis of religion is where Adam the first. And this is where he finds his norm. He doesn't find the norm in Adam the second by joining the community. He finds the norm by zitzni v'ram v'minatosis. He doesn't worry. He is sure. He starts with certainty. He doesn't start with doubt. He starts with certainty.
The mitzvah to him is a norm how to control the environment for Torah. What is the mitzvah in Adam the second, which I didn't elaborate on before in the Lonely Man of Faith? How does he interpret the mitzvah there? In Lonely Man of Faith, he interprets the mitzvah as a sacrificial act.
The mitzvah is sacrificial. In other words, by sacrificing my sin for Hashem, I attain kedusha. By restraining myself, kashrus, shabbos, taras, and mishpacha, all these things are acts of sacrifice. And sacrifice redeems the doubting, the uncertain, the search for meaning type of individual. And he sees in the mitzvah an act of giving up something to Hashem. In Ish Halacha, the mitzvah is a controlling a gesture. With this he controls the world. In the Lonely Man of Faith, with the mitzvah he brings a sacrifice. He brings a sacrifice. And one of his most popular quotes,
Maybe years ago I would not have dared to quote this midrash in public, which you always did, but today with television and everything else, this is pretty tame. On the Pesach of Shia Shir, the Pesach says, Sugo Bashoshana, his beloved is surrounded by a hedge of roses, all right? So, by the way, Dr. Norman Lamb wrote the book on Taras HaMishpocha, he named it Hedge of Roses, an excellent volume. So, he quotes, and Medrash and Rashi elaborates on this. Gedura umsoyeges begedesh Hashanah. The Jewish community is restrained and protected, surrounded by a fence made out of roses, which means it's actually a mental protection. It's not a building wall. Those roses, you can tread on them and walk through, and yet they don't do it. The motion is the famous story of the Bar Mitzvah. You know the famous story of the Bar Mitzvah, where he would go Kol Nidre night, Pesach at night, he would go up on the beam and say, is anyone who can sell me chametz, I'll give you $1,000 for a loaf of bread. See them, Pesach, chametz for Pesach, what do you mean? He turned and said, the Bar Mitzvah. The Tsar has contraband. You're not allowed to import silk without the taxes. And he has an army that surrounds all the borders. And anyone who gets caught is not only sent to Siberia, is shot. And if I want to go out and spend the money, I can get you as much silk as I want for the black market. And here, there's no police, there's no government, there's no jails, nobody's going to kill you, and try to get a stick of hummus from Aid. That is Sugo Bar Shoshana, because the Jew knows how to sacrifice, sacrificial act, and he dramatizes this. Harei chos nichnas lechuppah, the room is entering the chuppah. Libo megagas lechuppah ulechibas chosimah. His heart is yearning, trembling for the chuppah and for the love of his beloved. Bo Rizokeh, they come to relate Omolo, she says to him, Tipas dam kechadlo isi. I've seen a spot of blood the size of a seed of mustard. And I hope for the form of the tzadach, he turns the other way. Bela yoshka mochosh, a snake didn't bite him. Bela akrav okso, nobody bit him, nobody killed him. Harei shuhu, over by there, or a person walks on the road. All the choros, the rosh hatenim, these beautiful fruits, coming, bending over from a field. Pushes out your balita, he puts out his hand. Momentarily is overcome by the desire to grab that food. Omelo shalachem, does it belong to somebody else? For the other part. Is no shafyodim in agezim. That is the sacrificial act. So through the act of restraint and sacrifice, the Jew attains the kedusha, that union with his covenantal community, and meets his God. And I always felt that is really brought out beautifully in the Gemara in Maseches Tumah. The Gemara Maseches Tumah has a story about Alexander Mukhtin, Alexander the Great. He overran the whole Middle East, and he came, of course, to Israel as well. And there he encountered the Moses Chachma HaNegev, the wise man of the south. Who they were, I don't know. But they're a group of wise people, so he posed certain asoro, 10 questions he posed to them. One of them was, Ma yasa odam v'chag. What should a person do in order to live? They answered, Yomis is asmar, should kill himself. Then they asked them, Mayasa Odalim Vayomas, what should a person do and die? He says, Yechias Atzma, he should make himself live. So Rashi has a different shot, but the Marshal says, very partial. The Marshal says, the answer was, if a person really wants to live what we conceive to be life, he has to kill himself a little bit. He has to repress himself a little bit, he has to sacrifice a little bit, he can't do everything he wants, he's Sugar Bar Shoshana. If he wants to kill himself, let him live it up. Live it up. Today the world lives it up and kills itself in the process. With drugs and diseases and everything else. That's a sacrificial act. In halachic man, that's sacrificial. Church of Lord. This will put you in premature of the Torah on all reality, and that in itself accomplishes everything. Not that whole introspection and the thought and the worries and anxieties. Right. So you have a sikhas theory. The only thing is, Kaplan says, and it has merit to it, that in the ish halacha, he feels that what the Rav meant was that you only start out there, but eventually you come to the homo regulosus also. Because once that Torah personality is created, then he lives on a deeper existential level as well. Because that God of the Yisrael, who is the true Ish Halacha, has a certain emotion as well. In other words, he is not emotionless. He's not emotionless. And this is what the Rav always tried to impress people, that his grandfather and his great-grandfather were not emotionless people. We know, for instance, a Chaim Soloveitchik, who was probably the mother for his Ish Halacha, was a man who everybody knew. Any Oraman, do you know that any woman who had a child out of birth, out of wedlock, and even in those days it happened. They didn't throw it anywhere in a garbage can. They threw it in front of the house of a Chaim and used to take care of his children. He was a man of extraordinary compassion. In spite of the fact that he was an iron-willed intellectual disciplinarian. And he quotes like a story, I forgot who it was, one of his grandfathers, or even that brother Begon, I don't know who it was, I don't remember. He was in Simchas Torah, and the news came that the brother had died. He continued to dance, because the halacha says there's no aninus, no aveiros wanted. And the moment three stars were seen outside, he broke down and started crying. Even the emotions are regulated by the halacha. But it doesn't mean that he's not emotional. And he says that the person who is totally and ultimately disciplined by the halakha, and is totally intellectually disciplined by the ideas and perceptions of halakhic thinking, reaches that level of emotional expression intelligently, meaningfully, powerfully, and maybe there he touches that Adam the Second. Now, I don't know whether that is a satisfying resolution of the sphere of the two or not. The bottom line is that both essays were grabbed up on anything that he wrote is grabbed up on publication. But he certainly made an enormous contribution to the interpretation of religious experience and of the possibility to search for that in our traditional sources without ignoring the contributions made by other thinkers, and that makes him, of course, very much a philosopher in modern orthodoxy. Thank you very much.